Distribution states that our primary purpose is to carry the message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Valley Group honors this tradition by rigorously searching for the finest recovery speakers in the Western Hemisphere so that they can share their experience, strength, and hope with us. Each week, we recognize one of these speakers for their service to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. It is now time to recognize Valley Group Outstanding Speaker of the Week. The nominee for this category has a sobriety date of May 25th, 2010. I feel like I'm on The Voice or something. It's like crazy. He has been continuing in service many things. Coffee maker, greeter, secretary, CSR, literature, H&I, and as well as a sponsor. When I asked him what his favorite AA motto is, he said, easy does it, but do it. I like that. That's good. So, I've been waiting for this all day long. May I have the envelope, please? Woo! The winner of the Outstanding Speaker of the Week Award is Tim A. from Visalia.
Good evening. My name is Tim and I'm an alcoholic. And like Debbie said, my sobriety date is May 25th, 2010. My home group is the Monday Night Men's Stag Meeting. And I want to thank Bill for inviting me to share my experience, strength, and hope here at the Creative Center. And I want to welcome all our newcomers, new to Alcoholics Anonymous, our visitors, and everyone here tonight. I find a safe place here. I'm grateful for Bill establishing this meeting. It's been at least 4 years now, and I'm grateful for that because I've been on the sitting in the seats where you're sitting right now, and it's much easier, let's just say that, than being up here speaking, you know. And I've heard some great speakers here, and Bill's got CDs from all of them, pretty much, and I reflect back on those speakers, and I hope tonight you will hear something that maybe just one sentence that I say that you'll be able to reflect back on, and it might help keep you sober. You might be able to pass it on, because my time tonight, I'm going to try to give a message and not spread some kind of mess out there, and you know, and I can't always say that that's what I've done in this program. I'll start from when I was a kid. I was born in Hanford, grew up in Hanford, went there till third grade. My mom, she commuted back and forth to Visalia for her job, and that got to be tedious as well as dangerous because of the fog. And so we moved to Visalia, and that was in the mid-60s. And I remember my growing up in Hanford, pretty much I've always been a loner, never had more than a couple friends, always loved sports, always I was good at memorizing things. I remember spending a lot of time over at my grandma's house, bouncing a ball up against her garage, her wood garage. Just I was fantasizing I was in the major leagues or playing ball like that. And you know, I have great memories of growing up in Hanford and being, my grandma watched us quite a bit. My mom's a very hard worker, and I believe that part of my life, you know, that was instilled in me a long time. My father and my mother are very hard workers, and my grandma, who was, you know, she ironed to help it make extra money at home, you know, so she ironed and pressed clothes for professional people. And, you know, I just remember I isolated, I was a loner, and I wore glasses, I had buck teeth. You know, I never thought I was smart enough, good looking enough. But, you know, moving to Visalia, it wasn't like I was leaving behind a lot of friends, because, like I said, I only had a couple there. I still remember their names. Haven't seen them since the mid-60s. But I still remember who they were. When I came to Visalia, a couple friends, that's it. You know, we moved a couple times is all, since I've lived here. And, went to school at Mount Whitney, went through Viva Blunt, you know, and, I don't know if you remember Jefferson School. I went to Jefferson. It was a brick building, before they tore down, made a park out of it. But, there, a couple friends. It seems like no matter what school I went to, I was only comfortable with being with a couple friends. And tonight, you know, I could feel alone in a room full of people, or I could feel alone with just a couple people. You know, it's just, that's the way I am. And, pretty much, my bedroom was my domain. There, we didn't have TVs in every room of the house growing up like we do now. But in there, I had a radio, I had my books, I had Little Army Men or whatever. You know, those are the things I dealt with. And most of the time it was myself. I dealt with my own mind, my own fantasies that I was dealing with. And from there, high school, never was asked to go to a Kager. You know, I was kind of put out about that, you know, when I got to high school. You know, I don't know what I would have said. I was never asked, so maybe God was looking out for me there. Because I still believe if I started drinking when I was in high school, who knows if I would have even made it through those 4 years there. I grew up in a home. My mom and dad were divorced when I was young. Like I said, my mom's a hard worker. Didn't really get to know my dad too much. There was a lot of years passed before I really got to know my dad. And I'll get into that a little bit later. My mom, she married a man who, you know, he liked outdoors. He liked fishing, hunting, those kind of things. Liked sports. But he also liked to drink, too. He liked Coors, regular Coors. Back then, you didn't have to worry about recycling the cans because they weren't aluminum. And he loved Jim Beam. Those were the two things that he loved. Those were his loves. And I just remember seeing him get in the cupboard and take the bottle down from the cupboard and drinking out of it. And I really didn't think that was too normal. And he could down quite a bit of alcohol, a big man. And he had been injured in the military, and maybe he was drinking to kill the pain. I don't know. I just know I saw progression in him, and I didn't even know. I would consider that was an alcoholic. That's what I would consider. And but I saw a progression in him where he was unable to work, because of alcohol, basically. But growing up through high school, never drank. Didn't drink at all. I stayed away from it primarily because I saw what it was doing in my own home. My mom, she's not an alcoholic. She's not a normal drinker, but she could have a highball after work. I remember those, and that's how I know what a highball is. But my stepfather, he definitely could drink, and I think that's what kept me away from alcohol. In Bill Wilson's story, just in the very first page of his story in the big book, he talks about he was warned of the of alcohol, of what alcohol could do to him, and before he ever got away from home. And when he was in the military, Bill was away from home, and he took those drinks, and he forgot all about it real fast, and he was off and going. And I can say that was for me, too. I was 17 when I joined the military. I call it running away from home, but it really wasn't. I had no plan to go to junior college. My friends, the few friends I had, they were all going to a four-year school or going away. And the ones that were going to junior college, I didn't really know what I wanted to be. When I was fantasizing in that room of mine, you know, I would think I wanted to be a broadcaster, a sports broadcaster someday, go to broadcasting school and I heard some great ones growing up too on the radio. It's not the same as watching television today You know, today I can still listen to a game on a radio and enjoy it more than watching it on TV. And that's just me. You know, that's where my mind takes me. But I ran cross country in high school. That's a pretty much it's a team sport in one way, but it's a loner sport in another way too, and it's very lonely sport because you're basically running by yourself most of the time. And I did that my whole 4 years of high school, and so I was up here in this mind of mine for a long time. Let's just say that, and I don't know. I could. Go into lots of stories about that, but I'll go into when I left home when I was 17, joined the military. My mom signed for me. I turned 18 in boot camp, went to the Air Force. I remember that first night I went up to, before they swear you in, they put you in a hotel up there, and we were up on Motel Drive. And this is my first time really away from home with like people I didn't know and people. I mean, this is a pretty scary thing for a 17-year-old, and these guys were drinking in there. It was their last night. That's what most people would have been doing. They would have been drinking one last party before they were shipping out, and some were going to Vietnam, some weren't. And I had no idea where I was going. I was going to Lackland, and they were drinking beer. I had never drank. So, I mean, I'm just hoping this night ends. They were bringing girls up there into the room. They were doing all these things. And I was like, oh, my God, I hope this night ends. And when other people maybe they would have been thinking, man, I hope this night doesn't end. I was hoping it would end. And for me, when I got into Texas, I was all disoriented. It was nighttime, mid-morning. Middle of the night, morning, 1 a.m, very humid. We're talking the end of July, first part of August, and that's where I began my away from home travels. And I remember that's where I took my first drink. Was at in the Air Force at Lackland, and it was a few weeks after I'd been away from home, and all those things that I saw in my life for all those years didn't seem important to me anymore. Didn't even remember them, really. And I took that drink. It was a long neck, Lone Star beer. I didn't go crazy. I didn't like flip out or anything like that. And I didn't think I would, but I didn't know what it would do. Just drank a couple, maybe just felt a little bit of a buzz, and that's it. And then when I went on to school in Colorado, they had 3.2 beer there, and we could drink at our leisure, in between classes or after school or whatever. And I was rooming with a guy from New York who was older than me, and I remember I had some good times in the military, but that's where my drinking career picked up, and didn't start running. I went to California for my first base. It was Hamilton Air Force Base up in San Rafael, and there we were close to San Francisco within 20 minutes, and I'm 18, but I'm going into we're drinking on base because I could drink on base at that age, but we'd go into the city all the time, and I remember being pretty buzzed, walking the streets of San Francisco, nighttime. That's when the Zodiac was out there and all that. I guess that wasn't a good bait for the Zodiac, but that was the time. And San Francisco, that's where you do see people sleeping in the doorways and you see people, just sleeping on benches and that. And I never thought I would be like that. I thought those people were pretty low. One time I saw this guy walking down the Embarcadero, and he was just walking, and he was talking to himself and pointing fingers and just yelling and kicking this newsstand. And I'm like, dang, that dude's got problems. And I never thought that maybe someday I could be like that too. And from there, I wasn't at that base more than maybe 10 months, and that's when I went overseas to Okinawa. Vietnam was still going. This is 73 through 75 I was overseas. And that's where pretty much drinking is all you do, and work. I had a great work ethic. I was young. I think youth was part of the reason I was able to control and enjoy my drinking still, was because I was still young. I hadn't crossed that line, but I do remember getting drunk. I remember walking out in front of a taxi cab off base and getting hit by that taxi. I was drunk. I hobbled over to the sidewalk. They brought the ambulance from Camp Cooey, the Marine Corps hospital. I ended up going there. They put this full leg cast on me. I was downtown that next night, I remember. It didn't stop me. I remember our barracks, new guys from all over, Mercer Island, Washington, a guy I went skiing with named Ken Kurtz, up at Bogus Basin in Boise. Got to meet a lot of guys. I know now, and that's when I also was, integration was a big part. Where I went to high school, maybe there was two minorities there. You know, there was a lot of Hispanics, a couple black people, mainly whites. At high school, there was the goat ropers, the jocks, and then there was the nerds. I probably fit more closer to the nerd side of the thing, but I wasn't the big studious one, and maybe that's why I didn't get invited to too many Kagers, not even one, now that I remember it. And thinking back on that high school days too, was I never went to the prom because I was too scared. I was too afraid to invite somebody. So that's one of my things I always regret it until I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was able to let that go too. But getting to the part where I became, where my drinking was uncontrollable and I didn't enjoy it anymore. I came back out of the military, got a job. Didn't get a job right away when I got out of the military. I thought I was due a lot of recreation and I deserve a lot of fun time. And that's when I remember not having a job, but I had a severance pay from the military, some back pay. I remember drinking at the Monkey's Eye here in Visalia, Crazy Gilbert's, Holiday Inn, the airport Holiday Inn, and a place called the Tapper. You know, those were the places I'd drink at, and I just kind of just bounced around, and I wasn't really a bar drinker so much, but I did like the laughter, the enjoying part of that. I liked that part of it. And I did get to meet a few friends there, get to socialize some, but I never learned really social skills, to be honest with you. I had to be taught social skills, and that's in this program. Politeness, I could be polite, but when it came to the social skills, I could still interrupt people. I could still want to get my opinion out really before I not let the other person finish talking, and I'd interrupt them. Those are the kind of things I'm trying to learn today, and that's because of Alcoholics Anonymous too. I'm able to do those things. If I was still drinking, I don't know where I'd be. You know, I didn't get a DUI. That's still a yet. If I choose to go back out drinking, I could get that drunk driving. So I didn't come here with a lot of drunk driving, but what I did come here with was 30 years of alcohol running rampant. I was married into a family, 21 years old, right out of the military. I married a woman with two children. We had two children, and I was always gone. I was always working. I just had that work ethic. I loved working. I could obsess about work, exercise, eating, spending money. Those are all things that I can get on a roll on. And alcohol was one of the things that actually, it could control me some. But what it did do for me, which I regret today, is that I didn't spend time with that family. Had children, barely made it there for when my two children were born. I was always gone. I was either umpiring, refereeing, working overtime, coaching, infinitum. You could add it. And if I wasn't doing that, that's when I would binge drink. In between those things, I would have to binge drink. in order to fit in my drinking. You know, because I had that work ethic where I wouldn't drink and work at the same time. I wasn't that morning drinker where I had to have that drink right before I went to work. But what I did do was I saw a lot of, for me, I didn't see it right at first, but I was losing control of my drinking and I wasn't enjoying it. But my friends were more important than my family. That's what I thought. All these people that I would be out there with, I thought I had a lot of friends. And needless to say, when it came to me needing something, those people were always busy or gone. So true friendship I didn't have. I had acquaintances, basically. And they were good drinking friends, though. As long as I either had it or they had it, you know, it was... they were great friends, and those are fair weather friends. But I was married for quite a few years, from 1980 to the mid 90s, to the same woman. But she put up with a lot, quite a bit. I remember being embarrassed by her a few times, and she'd go out to the ball field maybe and like yell at me and. Right in front of my friends, embarrassed the hell out of me, and my friends were like, "Man, Jim, when are you going to get rid of her?" You know, or whatever. Well, you know what? She had every right to do that. I look back now, and coming home, she always had a meal for me. It might be cold, but all I had to do was warm it up. She was always there for me. She took care of the kids. I wasn't a father. You know, I wasn't a good dad. I loved coaching my oldest daughter. I loved coaching soccer, but that was my bond with her. But other than that, we weren't really close. It was all what I wanted to do. I wanted to coach. It was that selfishness, part that I wanted, and, that self-centeredness. I always wanted, and whatever I wanted, I usually stayed at it till I got it. And that was all the way from when I was a little kid. You know, I remember making maybe somebody feel guilty, then they would give in or whatever. And that's the way I worked. But in the mid 90s, I remember, my friends, they started, falling off one after another, getting divorces. And I was like, wow, what's up? Well, their wives weren't as patient and tolerant as my wife was. And these guys got divorced. They continued to drink. Some of them are still drinking today. Some are dead. Some are deceased. You know, I wasn't a blackout drinker because I took things to prevent me from blacking out. I could drink with the best of them. Any place I went, I would drink before I went there. Any party, any wedding, anywhere I went, I would drink before I went. I could not get there and be behind somebody else. Let's just say that. And I remember one time when I was still drinking, I was going to try to control my drinking at this one party. I was going to be the designated driver. And I bought a six-pack of O'Doul's. And they had a keg over there. And I remember I drank one O'Doul's, and then I thought, you know what? I'll drink one O'Doul's, one regular beer, you know, and that'll still cut it in half. So I did that, and then finally I quit. There was four O'Doul's left, and I just stayed on the keg. And then the people that I gave rides to, well, they had to get rides from somebody else, and I spent the night there. That's all I remember. And we were talking about going to the coast for breakfast. That's how we went, and. And I remember going to back when they used to have those pay-per-views a lot, over to a friend's house. Went to this one party there, and there was a girl there. She could do a handstand on a keg and drink from that keg. And I'm thinking, man, that's my kind of girl right there. You know? I mean, she could do it. She did that headstand, and she was drinking that beer right out of that keg. And I thought, man, she's gifted. And... you know, and those are the kind of things that, those are the places that alcohol took me. But it wasn't more than a few years after that where I was having problems at work. I was I already was having relationship problems. I was having financial problems. Self-pity, dishonesty. I was struggling, and in the big book they call that the bedevilments on page 52, and that's before you get to the first step. It's in that chapter to the agnostics, and I never knew what bedevilments were. I've been here 10 years, and just in the last couple of years my ears started perking up, and I started listening more. And like I said, I've been here since 2002, because I wasn't spiritually fit. Because I didn't work with a sponsor, because I went to tons of meetings. Meetings was not keeping me sane, and it was keeping me dry, but it wasn't keeping me sane. And I remember, I could be out there pretty good. My friends would worry about me. I had friends in here that would worry, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous via an intervention through the Tulare PD. Through a domestic violence, I didn't go to jail that night for some reason. My parents came over. They were in their 70s. They came over for here's their son. You know, his wife was leaving. This is my second wife now, mind you. And I had a 1-year-old. He was going to be 2. And all I could think about was, how could she take off like that on me? Or why did she call the cops? You know, I look back today and I know why. She didn't stay with me 15 years. She wasn't even with me 2 years, you know, and I know why today, because I wouldn't want to be with me either if I was she wasn't an alcoholic. She was barely drank some wine coolers, and that's my introduction to Alcoholics Anonymous. Came through a treatment facility, through Koya Delta, went through there. Graduated through there. My father, who was absent in my life for a long time, he came to the family meetings once a week on Thursday night. We'd have the family night, and he came to all 8 of those, and I'm very grateful for that. And when I graduated from the intensive care, my parents came to that. I was grateful for that too. But all during this time, my wife, she had filed a restraining order against me. She had filed for divorce. I wasn't able to see my children. And we're talking, this is in the time of October and November of where you guys are right now. And I didn't drink. I had a great woman who was my counselor at this treatment facility. She said that my wife couldn't take my sobriety. I'd have to give it to her, and that made sense to me. So I wasn't doing it to show her that I stay sober because of her. I was scared, is what I was. Scared of losing my job, still scared of everything. I had fear ran rampant, and I graduated through that program. It was a 6-month aftercare. Made it through that. Went to lots of meetings. I know a lot of people from this program, and I've done some things and not done some things. The things I've done, go to meetings, that I've done. I've gone to book studies, working with a sponsor. I didn't thoroughly work with a sponsor when I first got here. I didn't thoroughly work the steps, and I never completed the steps when I first got here. And what that was, I find out now, is untreated alcoholism, you know, by not finishing the steps and not working them on a daily basis. They're spiritual in nature. And by not working the steps, I wasn't spiritual. I was dry. I still had my mood swings. It was hard for them to be around me. I remember I'd have friends come up to me and ask me, am I okay? And I had trouble in relationships even in this program too. And by not being spiritually fit and having a solid foundation, any kind of roller coaster thing, whether it be financial, they always say finance or romance in the program. By not having that, then I was on shaky ground, and because I was, and I had a sponsor then. I have the sponsor I have today. I have a sponsor, the same sponsor, and he gave me direction. He gave me suggestions, and I would just I would half measure those suggestions, and what that led for me was a suicide attempt. Not thinking about my son, my other kids, my grandkids, my parents, and what that led me to was a suicide attempt, which eventually I came to. I didn't die, as you can see, but I woke up in the I woke up in the hospital, and I was tied down to a bed, and I had a big lady sitting there watching over me. And then 12 hours or whenever I would like wake up or come to or whatever from that, and I was out for a long time too. There was another big lady there, and I thought, man, this is the same one, but no, they were just two big ladies, and they looked alike. And I remember my sponsor coming, and a good friend in this program came, and my sponsor, he took one look at me and he laughed at me. And today I know why he laughed at me, you know, because I wasn't done yet. Didn't get enough, didn't listen, and had to go out and experiment some more. And I remember that's when I got released from that hospital. It was on a Friday night. I went to a meeting that I go to all the time, and where there's lots of sobriety. And the reason I went to that meeting was because it was on a Thursday night. I had gotten out of the hospital on the Thursday. I went to the meeting on the Friday. My sponsor, we had talked on the phone. My sponsor said AA could either save my face or save my ass, but it couldn't do both at the same time. And that made sense to me because I didn't want to lose my sobriety. I didn't drink. But what I did do, I took way more prescription medication. It was mine. But when you take it by the handful, that's not normal, and that's not something that eventually... it's been known that you would drink again. So I was better off. I knew what I had to do. So I called him back. He said it was within a few minutes I called him back. And within those few minutes, I told him I want to save my ass. And that's when we began the steps again. And I got a big book, no highlighting in it. We started reading the book together from the forward all the way. He would have me do some homework. But we would read page by page the forward and the doctor's opinion, all of that. And I know in the forward to the second edition, it talks about upon therapy for the alcoholic, we have no monopoly. And that's what it says. But it says if you've tried everything else and you haven't succeeded, then how about giving us a chance, giving Alcoholics Anonymous a chance, and join us on the road of happy destiny. And I'm kind of paraphrasing that, but that's what the forward to the second edition said. And then, you know, the promises, which are called the ninth step promises for a reason, because you need to get to that ninth step pretty much. But you can start seeing a lot of those promises before I saw a lot of them before I got there. But by working the steps again, and this time getting past step seven and going through, it's helped me. And spirituality-wise, I do what I need to do. I found a church that I could plug into, and that enhances my spirituality. Not everyone maybe gets plugged into a church, and that's not a necessity because this is a spiritual program. But for me, going once a week to church isn't so bad, because I'll still go to an AA meeting that same day too, and it just like feeds me really good. And prayer and meditation, the big book gives me suggestions on what to do before I even get out of bed in the morning. And do I do that every day? No, I can't say that, because once I wake up, these eyes open, my brain starts going. But the big book asks me to just take a second, just kind of review your day, what's in front of you, and ask for God's will and not my will. And it tells me what to do if I get agitated during the middle of the day. It says take a step back and pray, say the Serenity Prayer, ask for God's will again, And if that obsession and that craving come back, which it can, even without taking that drink, I know it could come back, but I know taking the drink will definitely make it come back, because I'm an alcoholic. Which what makes me that alcoholic is once I take a drink, I can't stop. And I don't know when I'll stop. And it's not how much I drank. It's not how often I drank. It's not even, it's what alcohol did to me when I did take that drink. And you too can, with Thanksgiving being tomorrow, I'm so thankful. I'm thankful to have my mom here tonight. I'm thankful to have my friends. All of you are my friends. I'd love to get back into sponsorship more. Working with others is the key. I see it in my friends today. And I've gotten, because of this program, and because of being able to do the ninth step, I've been able to make amends to people that I never thought I could before. I felt so shameful and guilty. I never thought I'd have a relationship with anyone before that of the things that I've done. And I've looked at my part of it. And that first time I did my my steps, I didn't do them thoroughly. My sponsor, he did it. He helped me the best he could, I guess. And I didn't do the sexual inventory, which it said to do. And for that, I needed to do that this time around. This sponsor had me do it all and my part and make that list of and ask God to remove those character defects and my shortcomings, and I've done that. What the fourth step did do, it exposed my character defects, and I have so many of them, and they can still rear up and they can show their ugly side if I don't stay spiritually fit, if I don't continue to work with others, stay in service, and not just that, but tell on myself. I heard in a meeting, and all the things, you'll hear lots of things in meetings, and I hope you keep them with you and use them when you need to. But in the morning meeting at the Alano, I heard a guy say that a problem shared is a problem cut in half. And that made sense to me. You know, I wasn't hiding that secret, or I wasn't keeping it within me. It doesn't mean going to a meeting and dumping everything out, because that's what my sponsor's for. That's what really close-knit people are for. But if you've got a problem, there's somebody there that will listen, and they want to help you. And I know today there's no reason for me to take another drink as long as I stay in the sunlight of the Spirit. And if I don't stay in that, I know I'm vulnerable again. And by relapsing and coming back to this program, even the pioneers in this program, there were some that stayed sober throughout, some relapsed, came back, some that just came back after many relapses, but their lives improved too. All I can say to you tonight is please stay. Please don't go. If you hear somebody talk about relapse, let your ears perk up, and maybe you won't have to go through that. And you hear people that say they never went back out, let your ears perk up too, and listen to see how they did it. And tonight, I'm so thankful, so grateful. I owe a lot to Alcoholics Anonymous and a loving God, because without either one, I don't have a life. And thank you, and God bless you.